Our gospel lesson for today comes from Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. I invite you to follow along. Jesus said, "The kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish, and five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy, and they slept. But at midnight, there was a cry, 'Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him.' Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out.' But the wise answered, saying, 'Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves.' And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.' But he answered, 'Truly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour.'" This is the word of the Lord. Grace, mercy, and peace be to you all from our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen. You are one of the chosen ones. The groom has requested that you serve in his wedding processional. You have a role in his special day. You are to be a torchbearer. You are to take your light and to shine it on the path that is in darkness. The groom has gone. He has claimed his bride. He has recruited his wedding party. And now he has gone to prepare a place for the bride, a place where they can live. You are honored by his request. You quickly gather the lamp and you wait. You wait for the moment, wait for the party to start, so that you can actively participate in the celebration. You wait with the rest of the processional party. With your lamp by your side, you wait, and you wait. You remember the echo of the warning that Jesus, that the groom has left you with when he says, "Watch, be prepared." And so you wait. And now it seems like something may have gone wrong. It is taking longer than you expected. It's taking longer than you expect for the groom to return. You know it shouldn't take this long, and so you wait. And as you wait, your eyes begin to grow weary. They begin to grow tired. They begin to grow heavy, and you wait. And your legs begin to ache because you're standing, and you're waiting, and you're waiting. And soon, before you know it, your eyes begin to seem heavier than they have ever seen before. And so then they begin to close, and before you know it, in your waiting, you have fallen asleep. I don't know about you, but I hate waiting. I hate waiting for anything. I hate waiting in line at a store. I hate waiting for commercials on TV. God bless Hulu and other such services. I hate anything that's going to require me to slow down and to take my time. I'm from a very impatient generation, a generation that's so used to instant gratification, a generation that's so used to instant access to what it is that we're looking for. And I think that we've become more and more impatient because of this. Some generations would mourn us as a lost cause. We see this as an opportunity. We've invented some of the most distracting and meaningless things so that we will never have to wait again. We've invented Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and anything we can do to pass time while we're waiting for the next meaningful thing to show up in our lives. I challenge you to scan any waiting room, to scan a waiting room at a hospital, at a store, at a return line, anywhere where people used to socialize, where strangers used to kill the time by talking to each other. Now you see everybody staring down at their palms, at a 3x5 piece of plastic as if it contains some sort of meaning of life. And if they just focus enough and they get the right combination, they'll find that meaning and everything will be clear. We're a very impatient generation and an impatient society. I didn't fully realize how patient I had grown to be until about 7 weeks ago. About 7 weeks ago, God blessed me with the birth of my first son, Jack. And that's when I fully realized just how impatient I can be. Because I've learned that there's nothing more dependable upon other people than a newborn baby. And this time, I've learned how to literally wait on him. I've learned how to literally be in tune with what he needs, to figure out whether he's upset because he's hungry or he's gassy, whether he wants to be bounced or left alone. I've had to learn to be in tune with every moment in his life. I've never fully known a clock until these last 7 weeks, as my wife can attest. Of course, I exaggerate because she puts in all the work. But as I wait on him, as I hold him, as I attend to his needs, I've learned that I can't do anything else but that. I have to just sit there and wait because he demands my full attention. I can't sit there on my phone or watching different TV because he knows when I'm doing that and he starts getting fussy again. And so he has taught me to wait. And at first this was very frustrating because it wasn't the world that I knew. But thankfully, I believe it's been a blessing in my own life because Jack has taught me how to slow down. He's taught me how to live in the moment and how to appreciate what God is doing in that moment and not just be so eager to move on to the next. I'm reminded of the words of an American preacher named Richard Brooks. Brooks is a man who is normally known for his poise and his patience. And so it was interesting when he was discovered by one of his friends pacing feverishly back and forth. His friend confronted him and inquired, "What is the trouble? Why are you pacing in such a manner?" And Brooks replied, "The trouble is that I am in a hurry and that God is not." The trouble is that I am in a hurry and that God is not. I don't think any truer words have been spoken about my own life, and I'm sure the lives of you as well. No truer words have described my own impatient existence. Haven't we all been guilty of being impatient? Haven't we all been guilty of refusing to wait for something to happen? It's as if it's some sort of a disease that is permeated into all of our life, a disease that has changed everything as we are unwilling to wait for the next thing, this disease of impatience and unwillingness to slow down and live in the moment. I must ask you, when was the last time you were incredibly frustrated? I imagine if you're thinking of that event, it's probably due to a lack of patience in your own life. Perhaps it was a meeting at work that dragged on way past its usefulness. Perhaps it was a time-consuming chore, a task that you thought you could do in maybe an hour or two, and weeks later it's still a big hole in the wall, and so now you're trying to get everyone else around you to learn what patience is. Perhaps it's a conversation that you keep having with someone that you love dearly but can't see the obviousness that you can see. And so you're constantly giving the same advice over and over again about the same situation only to have them come back. Patience. It's not as common as we want it to be. Who or what is it that seems to try our patience more than anything else in our lives? Who or what is it that seems to try your patience more than anything else in your life? Because we're all guilty of this. We're all guilty of being in a bigger hurry than God himself. And being impatient is a time that is very frustrating. Having to wait is a time that is very burdensome. Having to wait is a time that is very exhausting, like we saw in today's parable. This makes Jesus' warning even more stunning. How can we, the impatiently weary people of God, hold true to such words as watch and be patient? Watch, be patient, be prepared. These are words that echo from Christ himself in today's gospel lesson. These are the words that Christ says to the disciples and to us here today in the book of Matthew. Today's lesson is an answer to a question that was asked a chapter earlier in Matthew 24, verse 3. In Matthew 24, verse 3, the disciples see some signs of the end of the age, and they ask Jesus a question that we may have asked ourselves. They say, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" These disciples have a desire that I think is familiar to us here today. They want to know when. They want to know when is it that Christ will return and make all things new and reunite them as they should be. When will Christ return and make all of this different? Because if they knew when, then it'd be much easier to be prepared, wouldn't it? What's more frustrating than a repairman that gives you a 12-hour window? We like to know when. It's a common human desire. And perhaps you've made the same request. Perhaps you've got to your knees in prayer to God and said, "When is this going to be over?" Perhaps you're doing it right now as I preach. You can get off your knees. It's okay. It'll be over soon. No, but maybe you said, "When is this season in my life going to be over? When is this time of grieving, this time of doubt, this time of pain, of vindictiveness going to be over in my life so we can move on to something else?" Because if you told me when it was going to happen, then we could endure it. Or perhaps you said, when are you going to come back? When are you going to make all things new? When is this world going to make sense again as a Christian? And then I'll finally get my vindication for living so faithfully. Or perhaps you looked to God and you said, when will this journey end? Where are we going? How far is it that we have to go? Because then when you finally tell me where we're going and how long it's going to take, then I know that I'll be able to endure the journey. We've all asked these questions. They're very familiar to us. I must admit, in my own life, this is a question that comes up often in my prayers, is when. Thankfully, Jesus does give us an answer, though if we know Jesus' answers, they're not always as what we want them to be. But he does give us an answer in this lesson from Matthew 25. The verses leading up to today's parable, he gives signs of what the end of the world will look like. Signs that shouldn't be too different from what we understand, that it's not going to look great. The Old Testament reading for the day was from Amos, and they describe that the day of the return of the Lord is not always a day of joy for those who don't believe in the Lord. And so it was a day that we as Christians mourn as well, and we know that the return of God is going to come as the world grows darker and darker. So he gives them some physical signs, some warnings, and then he gives them two parables to wrap up the discussion. The first one is the parable of the 10 virgins or the 10 maidens. That's the parable that we're going to talk about today. The next parable is the parable of the talents, which we'll talk about next week, and I invite you back for what I know will be an excellent message. But this week, we look at the parable of the 10 virgins. So I ask you to look at your bulletin, or if you have a Bible with you, open to Matthew 25, and I'll actually wait a second as you do that. Matthew 25, we'll start at verse 1. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish, and five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy, and they slept. This is what we call a kingdom of heaven parable. We call it this because that's what Jesus calls it, so it's a good definition. But a kingdom of heaven parable is a story that has to deal with heaven. Heaven is something that's indescribable to us here on earth, and so God describes it through stories, through words that we can understand and compare. And that's when he says, the kingdom of heaven is like, and then he tells this story, which is what he's doing here. Then he quickly introduces us to a few characters. We have 10 virgins. Five are wise, five are foolish, and we have a bridegroom. But in order for us to fully understand what this story is really talking about, what this story means, it's important for us to understand what a wedding would have looked like in the time that Jesus is talking. And so a wedding in those days is somewhat different than a wedding in our days. In those days, the bride and the groom were generally arranged through their family. Their families would arrange the marriage at an earlier time. And then when it came time for the marriage, the man would have to pay a dowry or a fee for the bride. This would be what the family deemed the bride brought value to their home. If they had a working sort of family, what value needed to replace her so the man could take her as his own. And so they would come up with a fee, they would pay the dowry, and then the man would come and claim his bride as his own. But he wouldn't just take her there. He would have to go off somewhere else to prepare a place for them to live together. He had to prepare a home. For some, this could be the house next door. It could be addition to the house. For others, it could be towns and villages and lands away. But the man would have to go and prepare a place that he could rightfully bring his bride home to. Once he had done this, then he would return. And he would take his bride. And not only would he would go to his bride, he would bring his family and his friends, and he would go to the house of his bride, and his bride would come and meet him with her family and her friends. And together, the family, the friends, the bride, and the groom, dressed in their wedding garments, would go and process to the new house, to the new place that they would live together. And so it was a joyous processional. You could imagine being in a small village, knowing everyone knows when the wedding day is, everyone knows when this is going to happen, and finally when the groom returns and you see them all dressed up and you go off and you parade as a joyous celebration to the new home. Then when they finally got to the new home, the bride, the groom, their friends, their family, and all invited guests would stay there and they would have a celebration. They'd have a massive celebration, a feast. And for some, this could be a week. For others, it could be months. In months, but they would celebrate this union that God put together, that the families put together. And so that's what a wedding looks like in this parable. So in this parable, we see that the groom has claimed his bride, the arrangement has been made, he has paid the price for his bride, and he has set up the processional party. But you notice something different about this processional party. They all have to come with a certain tool. They're all told to bring lamps. Because, obviously, if you need lamps, it's going to be dark. So we can assume from this that it might take the groom longer to come back than was expected. And that he was going to come back at a dark time, a time where light needed to be shined on the path for them to go to where they needed to go. And so he sets up the processional party. He gives them a warning and a job that they need to have their lamps for his return. And then he goes off. And then it's told that five of these ten were wise, because not only do they grab their lamps, but they actually grab fuel for the lamps. Well, five are known as foolish because they only grab their lamps. They don't grab anything else. The time grows dark. It takes longer than expected. And we see that all 10 fall asleep. All 10 grow weary as the night comes and the darkness grows, and they all fall asleep. This is where we pick it back up on verse 6. But at midnight there was a cry. Here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. Here we see that the groom has finally returned. They have all awoken. They've heard the announcement that the groom has returned and the hour is dark. And immediately, five realize how foolish they have been. Five realize that they do not have fuel in order to light the path. And so foolishly, they ask those to help, and it's quickly known that each is going to be held accountable, that there's not enough oil to be shared, and so the five wise ones are going to be held accountable just as much as the five foolish ones. And so they can't share their oil, so they need to go and buy some. The hour is dark. It would be absurd for them to even find any vendor open, yet they take off from the party, and they go and they look because they were unprepared. This reminds me of a little boy who had a deal with his mother that he could stay up to say goodnight to her as long as he was ready for bed, because she worked a late shift. And it reminds me of the boy still dressed in his school clothes who eagerly awaits the return of his mother, and then he finds himself in trouble not for staying up, but for not being ready for bed, not being ready for her return. Now the groom has arrived. All know what needed to be done. There's no question, but it has become too late. Now that the groom has arrived, there's not enough oil to be shared. The foolish are seen for who they are, that each is held accountable. Earlier, all 10 were called to be a part of this party, but not all 10 took that call to heart. Only 5 took the call and were ready, while 5 did not prepare as if he was going to come back. We finish with verse 10 and following. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered, truly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. It's a pretty harsh parable, isn't it? I was talking to someone after the 9:30 service, and they said that they've had trouble teaching this parable because the kids always say, well, that's not fair. Why is it being so mean? And it is tough, and it is hard. And that's the reality of what Jesus is talking about. Because at his return, at the return of the groom, it's too late to buy the oil. It's too late to become prepared after it's already started. Like I said, no vendors were open. It'd be foolish to search. So the wise are celebrated because they were wise and they were faithful. So the groom returns and he faithfully prepares those who are celebrated. But the foolishly unprepared are left out. It says the doors are closed, and when they finally even find the party, the groom does not recognize them and casts them away from the celebration. Because when he came to return, they were not to be found. Jesus concludes this parable by then giving a stern warning to both the disciples and us here today. He says, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. So what does all of this actually mean? What does this parable say? Who are the people in this parable? How are we supposed to read it? The obvious character in this is the groom. The groom is Jesus Christ himself. The groom is God become man who loved his bride, the church, so much that he paid its price for the church. And he paid it very personally with his own blood as he died on the cross. And so the bride has come, and he claims and redeems the church through his blood, and then he leaves. And he gives a warning to the disciples that he will leave, something that we see, obviously, in our own lives, that he left. He ascended into heaven so that he can go and prepare a place for his bride to spend eternity in the celebration of the union. In John verse 14, he says to the disciples, "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again, and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also." So the groom has left to prepare a place for the marriage feast. The feast is obviously the celebration of heaven, the celebration of everything being made right, once again, our reunion with creation as it meant to be. The 10 virgins are those who have been called by God to celebrate, those who have called and heard that the groom is going to return. The early church witnessed that the return was not as quick as they thought. It was not as imminent as they thought. These disciples needed to learn that even though he was leaving, they were all going to be gone before he returned. And so this is the same warning to us, because we see that the return of Christ is coming at a dark hour. It's coming at an hour where the things around us are dark and seem as if they're going nowhere. Perhaps the world that we live in right now and continue to live, the darkness that has been ever since sin entered the world. And so we are called to have the lights. Many people say the light in this gospel, the lamp, is the word of God. The faith that shines and brings light out of the darkness. The gospel that Jesus Christ is Lord and has died and rose for us is the lamp. And for those who were prepared with this, they were celebrated because they brought light out of the darkness. So the obvious lesson here is that Christ will return. Some will be found faithfully waiting, like the 5 wise virgins, yet others will not, like the 5 foolish virgins. This is the obvious translation here. And the obvious lesson for us here today, then, is to be prepared, to watch, to wait. But the question that haunted me as I prepared this is, what does that even mean? What does it mean to watch? Do I sit in the couch and just wait? What am I supposed to be doing as a Christian in this world? What does it mean to watch? How do we make sure our oil is full? How does this parable really speak into the lives of those who are truly waiting the return of the groom? In preparing for today's message, I came across a writing from one of my favorite writers, a man named Henri Nouwen. He's a Catholic priest, he's a psychologist, and he's written a lot of meditative works that were very introspective. He asked a lot of questions and really wrote down how he truly felt, and God really spoke through this author. And one of the things he wrote was, I think, is about this parable. He says, and I ask you to follow along with me, and we'll break it down a little bit, so pay close attention. According to Nouwen, a waiting person is a patient person. The word patience means the willingness to stay where we are and live the situation out to the full, in the belief that something hidden there will manifest itself to us. Impatient people are always expecting the real thing to happen somewhere else, and therefore they want to go elsewhere. For the impatient, the moment is empty. But patient people dare to stay where they are. Patient living means to live actively in the present and to wait there. I love this quote from Nouwen because I think he gets at the heart of what it means to be a Christian who is called to wait and to watch. Because you and I live in a world that does anything but wait, a world that does anything but watch. It's a world that is fast-paced. It's a world that rewards speed, efficiency, and ingenuity, not those who sit and wait. It seeks reality in something else, which is what I think Nouwen gets the heart at. It seeks that the action must be going on somewhere other than where I am. And I think that's why we've seen the rise of popularity of such things as Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and sports and all of the different video games that we have where you can create a character and live their life, because the action must be going on somewhere else, not in this own meaningless existence that I think that I live in. The world does not reward those who stay still and live in the hope of a moment. According to Nouwen, the patient person is the one who is willing to stay where they are placed and to live there, believing the importance, believing that God himself has and continues to make himself known in that world, in that existence, in that place. The one who believes that importance will come to them, which I think describes the wise virgins. They heeded the call that the groom was going to return, and so they prepared themselves and they awaited his return. The opposite of this is the impatient person, according to Nouwen. The impatient person expects importance to happen somewhere else, and so they chase after it, and they continually chase after it, because once they finally find where they are, it must again be somewhere else. And so they live an exhausting life chasing importance in reality in something other than where they are. And so because of that, they settle on something less than what God has in store for them. I believe this describes the foolish virgins because they didn't take seriously the groom's warning. When the groom returned, they weren't reprimanded for not having oil. They were reprimanded for not being found when he returned. They didn't take his call seriously, and so when it came time, they feverishly sought something else to please the groom. And so when he does return, they're nowhere to be found because they weren't prepared for him. So not only are they not prepared, but they're also not found. For us, this is important because for us, some of us here are going to be found faithful. I pray that it is all of us here, that we're going to be found faithful at the return of our groom. At the return of Jesus Christ himself, we will be found waiting and we will go to the celebration and it will be a joyous day, a day that we look forward to. But for other of us, some here, and especially those in our world, this won't be a happy day because they won't be found and they won't be celebrated. Because of this, I believe God has placed us where he has placed us. He has placed the faithful in their position, and he says, be here and wait because I'm going to put others in your life that need the light. I'm going to put others in your life that need to know that I am God and nothing else is. And maybe this is why he placed you in your job. Maybe this is why he has placed you in your family, in your city, in the community that you live in, because he has a plan to bring the gospel light into those places. And this is why it's important to listen to this parable. Because as Christians, we are called to be prepared. We are called to heed this warning because he says, watch therefore, because we do not know when the hour will be. Perhaps there's a conversation that we keep thinking we'll have tomorrow with someone who needs to hear it. Yet we don't know when he's going to return. And so perhaps that conversation needs to happen today. And perhaps God is using other situations to bring those conversations about. The patient Christian is the one who has taken seriously this call, is the one who knows that the groom is going to return. It is the one that knows and lives patiently in the present. It's the one who tells of God's coming and what God is doing in their life, even in what might seem meaningless to everyone else. The patient Christian is the one who invites others to the celebration, and the patient Christian is the one who is fully awaiting and preparing for his return. After a long and exhausting wait, the groom has suddenly returned. He has already gone and he has prepared a place for his bride, a place of feasting, a place of joyous celebration. He has returned to take his bride and his guests to this place of celebration. He has called you to be an active participant in this celebration. I pray.